What choice do Californians have in this election? The biggest one of all. You have the power to choose a new direction for the Democratic Party, to break the back of a corrupt system of campaign finance that keeps a rigged economy in place.
Bernie Sanders. He'll stand up to Wall Street and make the wealthy pay their fair share and fight for tuition-free public colleges and universities. He has the best record on the environment of any presidential candidate and is the only candidate against fracking. Bernie has made the fight against injustice the work of his life. And now he's taken on a broken criminal justice system to stop racial profiling, prevent police misconduct, and end mass incarceration. Bernie Sanders. Make a plan to vote for Bernie this Tuesday, June 7th.
California, it's a long way to Washington, but you can send them a message they can't ignore.
I'm Bernie Sanders, Democratic candidate for president, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Bernie 2016.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, rather adorably, we humans see ourselves as rational animals. Now, sure, we do more reasoning than a plant or a card table, but in general, research shows us to be frequently irrational, often to our great detriment. Now, one of the best ways to act more in our rational best interest is to recognize all the ways we're irrational. And my guest tonight, Harvard Business School's Dr. Francesca Gino, is here to help us do that. Her new book we'll be discussing is Sidetracked: Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. Stick with us, and she'll explain how we actually get derailed in predictable ways, what those ways are, and best of all, what steps we can take to help ourselves stick to our plans. Hello, Francesca.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. You are just a monster of research. It seems like you do more studies than anybody else, and you've done studies with half the guests I've had on my show, so we'll talk about some familiar names. But I wanted to talk about the story you open your book with. You took a trip to Dubai, and you wanted to have this authentic experience at the market, you and your husband, maybe buy something authentic. But he got derailed in that. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, we were there visiting my family. And what was interesting about the experience is that there is a very nice old part of Dubai where you go and basically you negotiate all your way through the market, buying different types of things. And he actually got called by a guy who wanted to sell him a watch, and they negotiated, and at the end he walked away with a very, very expensive watch that turned out to be a fake, and he was aware of that. So a watch that would cost thousands of dollars in the United States is something that he was able to get for $100, a little bit less than that. And my husband, at the beginning, was really proud of himself. And he was walking in the market, basically thinking about the fantastic stories that he would tell his friends and his ability of negotiating the price for something that is valuable in the United States. But what was interesting is that by the time we got to our car, he started feeling a little bit inauthentic. And he started feeling like a fraud. And this was a story that was interesting to me because I was in the process of doing research with a colleague of mine, Dan Ariely, and another great colleague of mine at Harvard Business School, Michael Norton, on the idea that oftentimes what we wear gives us signals of who we are. And when the products, for example, that we use or that we wear are fake, we do, in fact, feel inauthentic. We feel like a fraud, and we also behave in the same way. And so in our research, we were able to show that that's what happens, that people who wear, for example, fake products end up cheating more.
Yeah, this is so fascinating, and I wanted to emphasize that your husband, this is one of those copies of watches, like the fake Rolex, but it looks real, you know, to many people. And you think you're doing something great, and the experiments you did were really interesting. They were on real and fake eyeglasses. I think they were Chloe sunglasses.
That's exactly right.
Talk a little bit about that, what you did and what you found from the people who thought they had the fakes.
Yeah, so we were interested in the type of signals that these products give to people and whether these signals are so strong that we end up behaving in ways that are consistent with the signal. So what we did in our studies, we actually received the real sunglasses from Chloe, and given the type of product, we decided to focus on women. But since then, we actually tested our predictions also with men, and there is nothing special about women in this case. Men and women behave the same. So we brought our participants to the lab, and we gave them these sunglasses to wear. We told them that we were interested in doing a little bit of an evaluation of these different types of products. And some of them were told that these were real sunglasses by Chloe, and some others were instead told that the sunglasses were a fake, they were a replica. And in reality, the glasses were real for everybody. So people walked around a bit, they looked at different types of things, and they were trying to evaluate the quality of these sunglasses. And while they were wearing these sunglasses, we also asked them to complete some tests. And we gave them the opportunity to cheat on these tests by reporting their own performance, for instance. And they had an incentive to cheat because the higher the performance they reported, the more they get paid. And what we found was that people who were wearing the fake sunglasses or who believe they were wearing the fake sunglasses, they felt more inauthentic and they ended up cheating more as compared to those who were wearing the authentic sunglasses. So even such a subtle and simple thing as wearing something fake does, in fact, make us behave like frauds.
It's so fascinating, and I have the numbers here in your book. You say that 30% of the participants who had the glasses, who thought, these are Chloe, they're real, those people cheated, but 70% who thought they had fakes cheated. And, you know, I love this point you make that, you know, what we wear, when we wear something counterfeit, it influences how we feel and behave, that we can behave more dishonestly, whether we realize it or not. And I love, you say, professors should beware, or maybe this is my note, I think it might have been yours, professors should beware of all those women carrying knockoff handbags.
Exactly. And some people, some of the listeners might be thinking, oh, I don't wear anything fake, I buy everything authentic. But there are so many other different ways in which in our daily lives we feel inauthentic. So, for example, let's think about our jobs. Oftentimes we're in jobs where we need to express emotions that we don't really feel, or we need to express opinions that we don't really feel. And doing just that makes us feel inauthentic, and that might also lead us to be more likely to cheat.
So here's a question for you. You know, there are people who feel not that great about themselves. If someone feels like they're a fraud personally, I mean, maybe you don't have research on this, but would they be more likely to be a person who cheats?
Yeah, so if in the moment we feel inauthentic and we feel like a fraud, we often tend to follow with our behavior. And so it's very likely that we'll be more likely to cross ethical boundaries. I do actually have some follow-up research based on the work that I was doing with Mike and Dan on just that. And these feelings of inauthenticity are actually quite powerful.
It's so amazing. And now I am talking with Harvard Business School's Dr. Francesca Gino. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. And you talk about how there are three different sets of forces that influence our decisions in ways that we fail to anticipate very commonly. And these are forces from within ourselves, forces from our relationships with others, and forces from the outside world. And this, the whole counterfeit thing, I mean, we really don't even imagine that, you know, how what we wear can trigger behavior that maybe we wouldn't have, a way we wouldn't have behaved otherwise.
Yeah, so the reason why I use actually that story right at the beginning of the book is to make that point that sometimes these forces are so subtle that it's difficult for us to realize that they're influencing our decisions. And so it's a way of hopefully opening our eyes and making us feel a little bit more humble and recognize that we are, in fact, human beings, and as such, we come with biases.
Right. And so now you talk about how we have these very inaccurate views of ourselves, and we often have an idea that we are more capable and competent than we are, and we are often unwilling to ask other people for advice, or if we ask for it, we ignore that. And you give the example of a game show on which people can ask the audience for advice.
Yeah, I have plenty of examples from my own life as well as the life of my colleagues or organizations I got to study where you see the same thing, where we believe that we are so good and that our perspective is the right one that we often do not even go out for other people's perspective, and we just stay fixated on our own information. That is an amazing, one of the best example that shows that too often see ourselves in a positive light was actually from a survey that was conducted by U.S. News and World Report in 1997. And they basically did this survey on 1,000 Americans, and these 1,000 Americans were asked a very simple question, which was, who do you think is most likely to get into heaven? And the people were basically ranking a bunch of people, and one of them was Bill Clinton, and he got a 52% likelihood of getting into heaven. The second one was Michael Jordan, who did a little bit better. He got a 65% chance of getting into heaven. This data is hilarious. Mother Teresa got a 79% chance of getting into heaven. And I love the data so far because it basically tells us that as individual human beings, we have very, very high standards. But the most interesting part of this data is that there was another category of people who ranked themselves even higher, and it was basically the respondents themselves, and they gave themselves an 87% chance of getting into heaven. So data like this tells us that the way we look at ourselves, our capabilities, our competence, our perspective is often too positive. And because of that, we fail to listen to others.
And one interesting thing you say about how we find the opinions of others to be less compelling and less convincing than our own, you know, that happens if we've invested time and effort in forming our opinions. We're big on thinking that effort, you write about this in a few places, that effort equals being informed and all sorts of other things that we should pay attention to.
Yeah, another one is actually how much, not only how much time we spent acquiring the information, but it could also be how much money we spent acquiring it. And again, we sort of deduce that it's going to be more valuable if we invested a lot of energy or effort or money in it, when in fact that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, actually, you tell a story. It was so interesting. You had worked for a company. I don't think that you sleep after reading your book and all the work and the studies you've done. But you worked for a company, and they expected some study to cost, they budgeted $100,000, and you very thriftily found somebody good to do it for $10,000. And they didn't like that because they needed it to cost more so they could feel good about it.
Yeah, it was so striking. I was so surprised by what I heard. And in the end, we actually had to go with the company who was charging us more money. My colleagues sort of laugh when they hear about this story because they take it as an indication that maybe they should charge more money for their time when they serve in the role of consultants for others.
No, I think that's good advice. And after I read that in your book, I put the book down and I got on the phone, called my boyfriend and said, you better be expensive in what you do. So, because, you know, it really does, we do associate, this is the thing that I love about your book, Sidetracked. I'm talking with Dr. Francesca Gino, and her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. That you show all these ways we think we are so smart and that we actually are so not. And then you do give solutions for ways we cannot behave like such idiots. But, you know, that's an example. And there are just so many ways that our psychology trips us up. Another one that you wrote in a chapter about how, you know, we have these inaccurate views of ourselves. You wrote about your dad who's a doctor and how he noticed that a patient would be more inclined to follow his recommendations, you know, on how to live a healthy life if they had to write a check right there than if their insurance took the cost and it was sort of seamlessly paid for.
Yeah, it's a as I write in the book, I have actually done research on this, inspired by the example that my dad brought to me, and it's the idea that again, if we feel we spent money or effort acquiring the information, then we sort of need to justify it to ourselves. And again, the view that we want to have is that we are smart people, and so we spend money on this, that you must be valuable. And so the same information or the same advice, once there is a price tag on it and we actually spend money acquiring it, it's all of a sudden it seems more credible, more valuable to us, and we do, in fact, consider it much more carefully.
And you say also that we tend to overvalue advice on difficult problems as opposed to easy ones.
Yeah, what is interesting about that, in my mind, is that we don't discriminate among people who have the same information that we have versus they have more or less information. Here's what I mean by this. Let's imagine that you're facing a very difficult problem at work or in your personal life or a very difficult decision, and you could go and ask for advice to people who basically have no better information that you have. But all of a sudden, since it's a difficult problem, you think that the others are the experts. And so you tend to overvalue what they have to say. It's interesting that we just don't even adjust for the fact that they like us, might not have basically no clue on how to solve the difficult decision.
Right. And actually, on the converse, you said that when we think the solution to a problem is simple, that we find ourselves brushing people off and just going with our own counsel. And so you talk about, you know, that and how we undervalue advice for simple problems.
Exactly. In the case, once again, we don't recognize that the situation is simple and we feel that we have good information, and we sort of disregard the fact that others might have a different view on the issue. And so we just don't even ask for their opinions, and we just stick with our own.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a message I got in this chapter, especially from this example that you gave about the German Walmart, where the German managers were lower ranking than the Walmart senior management who came from someplace else, but they were more experienced about how to get things done in Germany. And I got this message basically that we really think a little bit too highly of ourselves a lot of the time, and that we need to sort of back up. You talk about as a solution to this, to getting sidetracked by having these inaccurate views, you say raise our awareness, that we need to be aware that there are these subtle influences on our decisions.
Yeah, it's a little bit like looking at ourselves in the mirrors, and we are the cat and we see the lion. So I think the solution is to stop and edit. So I'm not saying that we should become pessimistic going forward or have negative views of what we can accomplish. What I'm saying is that these too inflated self-views can be problematic and can actually fuel overconfidence and make us go down a path that is not a good one. And so whenever we make decisions, we should be aware that we have that tendency and sort of pause and edit to make sure that we are, in fact, giving the chance to others to express their opinions, and we are considering information that is not just our own.
Right. And it doesn't mean that you're going to take that advice, but at least to consider. And this advice to pause, I think, is so important, because we can just be racing along. And just if people even pause and think, am I being sidetracked in some way? I think that that is very helpful. Another way we get sidetracked that you write about is emotionally, that we are very likely to get caught up in infectious emotions or our own emotions. And you tell the story of the two guys who started Yahoo. And it's just this way to put up some information on the internet that they did in college. And then it turned into this big business, but it was like their baby. And one of the guys was so attached to it that when they got an offer for it that was more than fair, like I think it was like millions and millions of dollars, he sort of became really difficult and it blew the deal.
Yeah, emotions can really cloud our judgments. I actually recently was in a negotiation myself for a house in Cambridge, and at a certain point I thought that the other side would be really difficult. And I teach negotiations, so I'm supposed to be the expert. And my husband actually looked at me and said, I think you should take your emotional temperature. And it was sort of reminding me of what I write in the book. It's very easy to get caught into the emotions that we feel in the moment and sort of lose track of the bigger plan that we had for our decisions.
That is so interesting. And you just reminded me of something. There's another point in the book at which you talk about when you're trying to, it's someone trying to sell a car who's leaving the country, and they have this this date. They have to sell the car by this date. And we would, of course, all think, okay, we're not going to tell the buyer, then they're going to have one up on us. But things like that, where we get all clenched and nervous and everything, it turns out that it's better to let the person know, you know, what your constraints are.
Yeah, it's another example of situations where we are so focused on ourselves that we forget to realize that the constraints that we have in reality is a shared one. So if we do not tell the other side about the fact that there is a deadline, if in fact they want to come to a deal, we're going to feel completely stressed out and wanting to make a lot of concessions to come to a deal. But if we actually tell the other side that we have a deadline, then if they're interested in reaching a deal, they're also going to speed up the concessions.
Right, because they want the car too. And if you don't sell them the car and you leave and the car's just sitting there, they're not going to have their side fulfilled either. So it really does help both sides.
Exactly. But again, we are so focused on ourselves that we feel to predict how, in this case, the deadline is going to impact both us as well as the other side.
I am talking with Francesca Gino, this Advice Goddess Radio. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. Now, something fascinating you write about is called emotional spillover, how emotions that are triggered by one event can spill over to another. And this is sort of a problem for me. You give the example of heavy traffic. I get really mad when people drive like idiots, and I'm probably one of them. So what happens when you get all traffic mad and then you get to your destination, you have to do something?
Yeah, so what we should be doing is breathe and just make sure that by the time we enter wherever it is that we're going, and it could be the office, we sort of leave our anger at the door. And we so often don't do that. And so that anger actually trickles over to other decisions or other things that we are doing and influences how we behave.
And now I wonder, I just finished my book, which will be out in June, and I referenced Daniel Goleman on emotional hijacking, or the amygdala hijacking. This is where the amygdala messages all the adrenaline coursing parts of your body, and they shoot out these chemicals that would have been really appropriate when you were being attacked by a hungry tiger. But once that's going, it's going. And so I wonder, you know, you've talked in your book about, oh, take a pause. Maybe it's not possible for somebody who's become really enraged for some reason to negotiate or deal in a balanced way with what they're doing because of this emotional spillover.
Yeah, so you might be so in the moment that you might be, you might need somebody else to remind you of what is happening. So and that's the story that I was telling with my husband, where he was the one looking at me and saying, look, you should take your emotional temperature. I was probably too angry to recognize that I was feeling anger.
But Ashley, this is really great, and I don't really think you wrote about this in the book, but my boyfriend does it for me, too. You know, I write about manners, and when I'm being a jerk, he'll remind you what I'm doing and that I've written about this. It's really good because you can't often see yourself. This is this emotional blindness, and so it's good to have someone to allow that. You know, people who snap somebody's head off, who says something to them, who cares about them, that makes it not so possible.
It's actually one of the messages of the book is that we should think about our networks a little bit differently. Rather than having people who just like what we say, they ask the difficult questions, and so they are the ones telling us that maybe we should raise our awareness, or they are the ones that tell us that maybe we should take our emotional temperature. I think that having friends or colleagues like that quite helpful.
Yeah, and you do make that point, you're right, about the advice when you know, how to take advice. And actually, you have to, I think in order to do that, you have to realize that we're fallible as humans and accept that you are fallible as a human, which I luckily do. And I've mentioned this on the show before. I have an editorial assistant whose job is to tell me I'm not funny, I'm an idiot, I shorted the science. And then I have a copy editor. I mean, and I really, it took me a while to convince them that I want them to treat me like I'm an idiot. I mean, not really, but to find the flaws for me, because then you can make it better. And I think if you have that attitude, but only with people you trust, you know, you have to trust their minds and their judgment and everything. But then that's really good. Like your husband, my boyfriend, these are very helpful things to have in your life.
I agree.
So you also, this is so fascinating. This is our catty side. You write about these researchers, Scott Wiltermuth of USC and Lara Tiddens of Stanford. They hypothesize that anger increases the appeal of evaluating others because we have this desire when we're angry to lash out at them. So did they prove that hypothesis with their research?
They did. They had a series of beautiful studies where they proved just that. And going back to the idea that sometimes it's not just the anger that we experience in the moment, but it's anger that was actually triggered by something completely unrelated, like being stuck in traffic, they have evidence for that too. So there are, when you bring participants to the lab, there are different ways in which you can elicit emotions and make them angry. For example, you could ask them to watch a clip from a movie where somebody is treated very unfairly. And as it turns out, when we experience anger, when we feel angry, we want to lash out. And one of the way we do that is that we decide to negatively evaluate others.
Yeah, so very interesting. It's our catty side. And even weather, it turns out, influences our decisions and feelings. I think it's really important to recognize this. And you write that predictably, people feel happier on sunnier days, but that even like mentioning the weather on rainy days would influence people's happiness.
Yeah, it's go back to the idea that even these subtle things that happen in the environments that we're part of can influence our way of being, and the weather can actually influence our emotions. I have done some research actually recently looking at how weather influences our own productivity. And what is interesting about weather is that it influences our emotions, but it also influences our thinking in the following ways. So on rainy days, if you go to work, you actually end up being more productive because you're not there thinking that you could be outside instead enjoying the sun. And instead, on sunny days, you get distracted because part of your mind actually wonders what is it that you could be doing rather than being at work.
This is why we're all lazy on the West Coast, because it's nicer here.
It'd be interesting to actually look at people's productivity, for example, in academia once they move from the coast to the West Coast or vice versa.
Well, you know, actually, I have curtains. I have a little office, like a fast food stand with a window, and then it's inside my house. And so, and I actually have to close the curtains because I need to not see outside. And I wonder if I was, I didn't really realize why, I hadn't read your research, but if that was to block out the beautiful, sorry, I'm gloating, the palm trees and flowers and everything, because I'm in Southern California. So, you know, it's pretty nice here, and maybe I wouldn't get work done if I saw that. So
yeah, you
all...
have. You seem to have a nice mechanism to defend yourself from that possibility.
Well, now more that I've read your book, and this is Advice Goddess Radio. It's Amy Alcon talking with Dr. Francesca Gino from Harvard Business School. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. And I want you to talk a little bit about emotional contagion. We can actually have emotions transferred to one person from one person to another. How does this impact our feelings and decisions?
Yeah, it's an amazing set of studies that shows that, for example, if you think about being a group of friends or even being a group of people at work working within the same team, that the emotions that one experiences actually do lead to contagions and affect others. So if I'm feeling particularly anxious, I might make my entire team feel very anxious as well. Or if I feel angry, you end up being angry as well. And it's quite striking because, that, as we were saying earlier, these emotions can really derail us. So, for example, they could lead us to make very different judgments about others or change plans, even when we were very clear on what we wanted to do.
Yeah, it's so interesting how we're sort of the puppets in a lot of ways of these influences, the outside influences, our emotions, and you give actually some really good advice for how to avoid getting sidetracked by your emotions, and it's to take your emotional temperature. You say to carefully consider your emotional state when you're making a decision, because maybe tomorrow in a cooler head, you would decide in a cooler way.
Yeah, I think it sounds cheesy a little bit, but it's actually a principle or a strategy that can help. So some of my colleagues and some of my students actually use it when they go off and negotiate, because you might be disappointed with what you're feeling from the other side of the table. And if you realize that you're feeling strong emotions, then maybe it's better to break off the negotiation, take a pause, or just make sure that you come back to the table with a cool head.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Another way that we get sidetracked is to become too narrowly focused. We may miss the big picture. We end up ignoring information that would improve our decisions. And you tell this wonderful story about this Chinese woman with two large pots on the end of a pole and one is cracked. So tell us that story.
It's a story that introduces the concept quite beautifully. So it's a... Imagine this Chinese woman walking with, walking from a river to home for days after days for every month of the year, and one of the pot is cracked, and seems very disappointed for the fact that this.
Let me just say that she's carrying water in the pots, and these pots have personalities.
Exactly, the new personality in this fairy, in this sort of fairy tale from China. But what is interesting is that the two pots that you were saying have water in them, but one is cracked, and so obviously the pot isn't unable to bring all the water that she's supposed to home. And at the end of the year, the pot talks to the Chinese woman, and she confesses being very upset about the fact that she sort of doesn't understand her purpose, given that she's cracked, and so she's not able to fulfill her job completely. So basically, she was very focused on the fact that she had a flaw. And
just
the Chinese
the
woman, yeah, the pot. And the Chinese woman basically tells the pot that she knew about the flaw. She knew about the fact that it was a cracked pot. And so for the entire year, she's basically putting seeds on the side pot that was cracked. And so there were beautiful flowers on the path, so from the river to home, to her being the cracked pot. So it's a sort of a funny, strange story, but I think it does tell us that oftentimes we are so focused on the details of the situations that we fail to step back and see the entire picture. And in this case, the cracked pot was too focused on her flaw, and she didn't realize that she was actually doing something beautiful.
Yeah, it's so, so interesting the ways that we think, we really think that we're paying attention. And Christopher Chabris, who was on my show, he talks about horrible things that happen where people think that they are reliable eyewitnesses, and few of us are, and people are convicted on unreliable eyewitness accounts where the people swear they saw what they saw. But they actually, Christopher Chabris and his research partner, Daniel Simons, they did a hilarious study that showed our inattentional blindness. Basically, there was a gorilla on the basketball court, and people didn't see it. So tell us about that study.
Yeah, it always fascinates me. The video is actually online, so the listeners, if they're curious, they should go try to find it. But it's basically a video clip where I would tell the people in the audience to just focus on the fact that there are going to be two teams of basketball players passing the ball to each other. One of the teams is wearing white shirts and the other team is wearing black shirts. And I usually ask participants to just count the number of passes among the members of the white team, the team wearing the white shirts. And then I go ahead and show the clip, and people are very focused on the task. And during the clip, there is a person dressed up like a gorilla basically passing through the screen across the entire field where the people are playing basketball. And people were counting the passes. They're so focused on the task that they actually miss the gorilla.
And they insist, you know, that there was no gorilla until you show it the second time. I mean, it's so amazing because so many people miss this. And it just shows, you know, that how we have this narrow focus of attention, we don't even realize it. And you actually say, you know, their findings should make us think twice the next time we find ourselves multitasking, because we are not paying attention as well as we think we are.
Yeah, I think that we all believe that we're going to be able to text while driving or surf the web while working on something important, and we just can't. We believe that we're able to divide our attentions, but when we're really focused, we miss stuff very easily.
And actually, what's sort of chilling, you found that actually you and your Harvard colleague, Max Bazerman, found that people fail to notice changes little by little. And that can be true when there is an ethical erosion that just happens, you know, a little more, not like, you know, Bernie Madoff all of a sudden gets discovered. So, you know, that's something that slips by us.
It's interesting that I have a colleague at a Harvard Business School who talks to Bernie Madoff on a regular basis, as well as other people who have been involved in scandals and cases of corruptions, organizational corruptions. And one of the things that he tells us is that what seems to be common across all these stories is that it didn't happen all of a sudden. It happened step by step, and people really failing to notice that their behavior was changing.
Yeah, because it was a slow, slow, slippery slope. It wasn't just a big drop-off, which we have an easier time catching.
Exactly. It's a little bit like not noticing that you're putting weight on until you don't fit your pants anymore.
Hey. Talk about in your book how we can be swayed if somebody's in our social group, if somebody we think is like us, and a lot of people who are Madoff victims were people who were in that whole set. You know, they thought, oh, okay, he's one of us. You know, we can trust him. And I think that that's something that you show as well.
Yes, we actually took this question into the context of ethics. And the reason why we did that is that ethics is one of those contexts where if I ask you, do you care about being a good person? Do you want to be seen as a trustworthy person by others? I bet that you would say, yes, of course. And most people do. But what people don't realize is that very subtle social and situational pressures can actually basically really sway our moral compass. So we had a series of studies where we were interested in the question, if you see another person cheat, would that influence you? And so we created studies where we gave people the opportunity to cheat, but we also, in some of the conditions, we hired confederates that were basically showing others that you could cheat and get away with it. And what we find is that even just the behavior of another person cheating influences your choice to cheat. I think it's actually quite amazing because it suggests that even in contexts as important as ethics, the behavior of others has a huge power and huge influence on what we do.
So fascinating. I'm going to get to that. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Amy Alcon talking with Dr. Francesca Gino. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. I just wanted to get into the advice you give for when we become so narrowly focused. And you talk about the pointless painter, George Seurat, who painted in all those little teeny dots. And you say that you can't see it when you're really close. You have to zoom out. And that's the advice you give to people when they're making decisions, to back up from it, you know, so they don't overlook things that are passing them by at a close range.
I feel that each of us should have sort of a checklist, like doctors and surgeons have before going into surgery, with sort of the questions that we should be asking ourselves. And so zooming out could be one of them, to make sure that we're not lost in the details of what we're doing, but we're taking a step back and really thinking about the goals that we want to accomplish and what our action plan was.
This is actually a great idea. You could do this with the 9 principles from your book, the ways that you say you can help yourself not get sidetracked, like zooming out and taking your emotional temperature, because you could do those 9 things and then maybe not buy the wrong house or make terrible decisions. And I was just thinking back about Bernie Madoff. Elie Wiesel, who has some Holocaust Foundation, I'm sure he had no idea that this person in his religious and social group, who, you know, this is this Holocaust fund, would cheat him out of all the money. I think he lost everything. And it's just so sad when that happens. But you say that this is very predictable because a feeling of connection to another person or group or even a country can influence our behavior without us even realizing it.
Exactly. One of the studies that I conducted is, in fact, in the context of ethics and shows that when we feel connected to others, for example, even if we share something that is similar to them, we went to school together, or we have the same name, or we have the same birthday, even just that creates a sense of psychological connection that then influences the way we behave. There is actually a study by a famous social psychologist, Robert Cialdini, where the sense of psychological connection came in the following way. It was a study they conducted actually on real people in real hotels, and he told some people that 75% of the people who stayed in this hotel behaved in a certain way. In their research, it was about reusing towels on the first night of stay. And what is interesting is that these are people you don't know that somehow decided to stay in that particular hotel, and yet we feel connected. And they also had a condition where they told some of the people in the hotel, 75% of the people who stayed in this room, like you, reused their towels on the first night of stay, and the effects were even bigger on actually changing the behavior of people. And again, it's because they felt connected to these people who they don't know who stayed in that particular room. So the way in which we feel connections to others are sort of bizarre at times.
They really, really are. And this is too, and I'm looking at the different messages. The first one was help save the environment. The environment deserves our respect. And then that one that you're talking about, the over 75% of guests who stayed here, who stayed in this room. I mean, it's so amazing. A bunch of strangers also booked this hotel on Priceline.com. And we feel connected
exactly.
with them simply for that reason. And we don't even think about it. And you say that to avoid getting sidetracked in this way by these insidious social bonds, that we need to question our bonds. And also we talked about before to surround ourselves with ethical people, since that can be contagious too.
Exactly. It's really thinking a little bit more carefully about the people in our networks that we interact with, and making sure that we carefully consider who they are, such that we're influenced for the good behaviors rather than the bad ones.
And now another way we're motivated is through social comparisons. And I love this. You tell this story about yourself in stickers at the gym.
Oh, my goodness. That was so much fun.
So how are you motivated by stickers?
Yeah, programs at the gym where if you go to different gym classes, you get a sticker that is in the form of a star usually. And there is a sense that you end up seeing a variety of people who go to gym classes because they want their stickers, and start comparing how many stickers you have to the number of stickers that other people have. And I found myself actually going to the gym and staying for like 3 hours so that I could get 3 different stickers and do better than people I knew who were also getting the stickers. What is interesting about these social comparisons is that we actually engage them really on a daily basis in all sorts of dimensions. If you're trying to understand whether you are attractive or whether you are an interesting person or whether you're a good cook, you start thinking about other people and then whether or not you are better than them on that particular dimension. And there are situations in which we just fall short in these comparisons. So, for example, we might compare to the other person going to the gym and realizing that we have fewer stickers than they have. And when we fall short from the social comparisons, we feel bad. And we also feel usually a sense of envy. And because of that, we might engage in all sorts of dysfunctional behaviors, like even sabotaging others so that we can improve and not basically face the same type of social comparison we were facing before.
It's so amazing because, I mean, the thing you present with stickers, we're all like this, but, you know, if you hear it and you're sort of standing back from it, you realize how we all sound like six-year-olds. But we just are perpetually six, you know, and it's so interesting. And actually, Leon Festinger, you write about how Festinger, who came up with the theory about cognitive dissonance, which we've discussed in the show, he says that we're more likely to compare ourselves to people whose opinions or abilities are similar to our own, and less likely to compare ourselves to people whose skills and abilities are more divergent. And you give the example that most listeners readers would be more likely to compare themselves, you know, to work colleagues than to Steve Jobs when assessing their ability to reason through business problems.
Exactly.
So, and it seems sort of important to actually have people, you know, it's like playing tennis, that you want a partner who can challenge you a little. You want somebody that you can aspire to, you know, to get to. If you're the top, that seems to maybe hamper you a little bit.
Exactly. Or we should, again, realizing that we engage in these social comparisons very naturally is important because we might very exclusively try to reframe our envy into something that is more beneficial, like admiration. And it's very difficult to do, but if we just stick with envy, we're going to engage in behavior that probably derail us in ways that are not good for our plans.
Well, can you explain how you would do that to transform envy into admiration? Because that sounds like a good idea.
It does sound like a good idea. There is actually some research on this. A colleague of mine is looking into this, since there are so many situations in which we do experience envy. One way is to focus our attentions on something that humanizes the other person we feel envy towards. So, for example, if the person, if we know that the person wasn't always successful or that she or he experienced failure in some ways, then focusing on that can be actually quite beneficial because we realize that they're more similar to us. And so we might feel that we admire them rather than feeling envious towards them.
Yeah, that seems like a wise idea. And you say also, you know, that we need to check our reference points, you know, when we are making a decision, because we can get sidetracked by this, that we may be making decisions based more on our comparisons with other people than anything else.
Exactly. And once again, we do that naturally. We are such a strange and amazing human beings, and so being aware that this is happening could be quite helpful.
And now tell us about something, basically we will sometimes take in some irrelevant information. There's something called attribution bias. What is attribution bias?
We think about the last time you arrived late at the office, this has happened to you. The first thing that tends to happen in your head, likely, is I need to explain this away. You start thinking about the fact that you were stuck in traffic. So there was something external that made you arrive late. But now let's think about the situation in which you see a colleague of yours actually arrive late at the office. Where our mind tends to go is basically saying, oh, this person is not reliable, rather than using, like we did in our case, external factors explaining away the behavior. So the fundamental attribution error is basically an error that we make by failing to consider how the situation is impacting the performance of individuals, and we tend to reason differently when it comes to explaining our own behavior as well as and explaining the behavior of others.
Yeah, we're just so much kinder to ourselves. I love that there's, you know, in traffic, you know, we made a mistake, we're a good person, we were just distracted, and the other person is a horrible person who found our home, waited for us to leave so they could screw with us in traffic. And really, there's so many times we think of that, and if you realize that, you can maybe not do that, because we should just be more charitable as we are to ourselves, to other people, because we get so angry, and they really, a lot of times, it is just that somebody's distracted and not that they're a horrible person.
Exactly. Somehow, once again, we're very focused on ourselves, and it's very easy for us to rationalize the things that we don't think tell a good story about who we are. But when it comes to others, then we behave a little bit differently.
And now another way we do this, there's something called correspondence bias that you write about. And I should say who I'm talking with. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with Harvard Business School's Dr. Francesca Gino. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. So correspondence bias that you write about, this is how we tend to ascribe too little influence to the situations people have been in and too much to their disposition. So it isn't that the elevator was broken, it's that you're a lazy jerk, and that's why you were late.
Yeah, it's relevant for a variety of situations. One of them is thinking about evaluating others on their performance. So one example that I often use is thinking about two different salespeople. One is doing incredibly well, selling a product that is new, very innovative, that the customers want because it's a new product in a market that is very, very hot. And you can imagine another salesperson who's doing well, but not as well as the first one, but he or she is selling a very old product or a product at the end of its life cycle in a market that is not very hot. So if we were thinking about how to evaluate these people, and maybe even who of the two should be promoted, we would go very naturally to the first one. And we would sort of not realize that maybe we should account for the differences in the situation and the hotness of the market when we evaluate their performance.
Yeah, I think that that's very important. You look at kids in schools, kids from a bad school, you know, that they have a lot more to go through to deal with, you know, than kids who come from homes where they're really supported and you know, they have all the advantages. So that would be one example of that, I think, as well.
Exactly.
And now we judge, God, I just read this book and I think, God, we're so irrational, we humans. You write about how the height of the pile on our desk can influence judgments of our own productivity.
Isn't that interesting?
It's amazing.
Yeah, it makes us think about all the times where people could be sitting at their desk, working away, or at least that's what we think, but in reality they're just surfing the web, and we think they're so dedicated to their job and they're so productive.
Yeah, we really do. We look at effort instead of outcome, and this really punishes people who are really efficient in the way they do their jobs. You know, instead of these people who are, you know, like you said, they're at their computer, but you go by the back and they're on Facebook and not their spreadsheets.
Exactly.
And so you give one of these tips that you give to avoid getting sidetracked is to consider the source, and that we need to fully consider the information surrounding important decisions, go beyond the gut feeling. You know, and I think, you tell this great story about employees. Their productivity is judged in a store, and these employees, some of them seem to be doing very well, and actually it's because they're buying merchandise at the end of the month and they return it right afterward after they're judged, and that if we have feedback and information from several sources instead of just looking at the surface, we can maybe avoid the biases.
Yes, and there are lots of situations where we're just not asking enough questions about where the information is actually coming from. And so that might lead to judgments that are actually incorrect or decisions that are wrong. And so being a little bit more careful and considering the source can be quite helpful.
And now another thing you talk about, which I just love, is framing. And you write that the way that we frame information we present to others can substantially influence their decision-making and judgment about the information. And you give this example that people evaluate the same products more favorably when they are described using positive proportions, like 75% lean rather than 25% fat.
Yeah, it's amazing. I have an exercise that I do in my classes or whenever I talk about this, the framing effect, where I basically ask people to read whatever they see on the slide out loud and as quickly as they can, and half of the room to close their eyes and the other half is doing the exercise. And the first group basically reads a few numbers, and then they get to a letter that looks like a B, but really could also be read like a 13. So it's an ambiguous piece of information. And the people who were just reading numbers then say 13. Then I ask them to close their eyes, and to the other half, I ask them the same thing, but this time they're actually seeing letters. And when they see that ambiguous piece of information, this time they say B. And it's amazing to just basically see that and see the fact that we use whatever to frame on a decision or on information as a lens that influences how we decide or how we choose.
It's so fascinating. And you say that one way to avoid this is to investigate and question the frame. You talk about thinking counterfactually, which is like that movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow, where she didn't get on the train in one version and she did in the other, to think about, to play that out and see what would happen in each, if you decide one way versus another.
Exactly. It's very difficult to realize that there might be another way of looking at the same situation, and that somehow the context provided the lenses that put us down a certain path. So I think the question in the frame could help with this issue.
Now, we are almost out of time. I wanted to ask you to leave us with some final words of wisdom. And I should say who you are. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Amy Alcon, talking to Harvard Business School professor Dr. Francesca Gino. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. So some final words of wisdom on not getting sidetracked.
I think the best piece of advice is actually something that I started doing myself, which is just give up the idea that we're perfect, because we aren't, and we have a lot of evidence that we fail thematically in the ways we make decisions. So start with the different assumptions. We're not perfect. Instead, we have imperfections, but we can work on them. So rather than leaving the show tonight thinking pessimistically, knowing that we can have a checklist of questions that we ask ourselves, and we can, in fact, improve and stick to the plan.
Thank you. I think that's wonderful advice. Admit that we're fallible, because then we can see all these things much better. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Amy Alcon talking with Dr. Francesca Gino. Her book is Sidetracked, Why Our Decisions Get Derailed and How We Can Stick to the Plan. Thank you so much, Francesca. It was a great show. You're fantastic.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Grand Canyon University is Arizona's premier private Christian university, committed to providing